You're listening to Strange by Nature, your guide to the strange, weird, unbelievable, and improbable wonders of the natural world.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here today. I am Kirk Mona, and I am joined today by Rachel Ginza and Victoria Thompson. We are all professional naturalists who together have scoured the world for weird and wonderful wonders just to please your mammalian brain's desire for novelty. Isn't that nice? Let's do this.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Good to see you guys.
Good to see you too.
Good to be here. This is a great day.
Yeah, it's the beginning of season four.
I can't believe we're 4 years in.
Yeah, how did that happen?
I don't know.
I suppose one day at a time, huh?
Yeah. I guess.
Well, we're glad that everyone's here. I know the numbers have gone up over the years. Say, before we jump into the show, I need to address something I realize I haven't talked about in a while.
Ooh.
It's the whole Australia-Canada controversy.
Yeah, Brett did mention that last week.
For the new listeners, you know, it's sort of this whole thing about who do we have more listeners from, Australia or Canada. I will admit we sort of pit them against each other and said, hey, who can take the third spot? The UK has been very firmly in the second spot for a long time. And Australia was in fourth place. They told their friends to listen to the show. They spread the word, got up to third place, and they have held down third place for months now.
Amazing.
In the standings. I just recently looked at the last 3 months of the show for some of our stats, and I was like, oh, look at that. Australia is still holding strong in third. So way to go. I guess maybe, you know, you could try to unseat the UK if you want to tell your friends to listen to the show. That'd be amazing. Could we imagine if Australia got to the second spot?
How much time that we spend in Australia on this show?
We do talk about Australia a lot on the show, yeah.
Well, yes.
But I do have an announcement of something else that happened.
Ooh. Oh?
Canada. Oh, sweet Canada.
Oh, Canada.
Oh my gosh. You are no longer fourth place.
Oh, no.
You have slid to fifth. A dark horse has come from the wilderness and upset the balance of things. Do you want to know who kicked Canada down to fifth place?
I'm all agog.
I have no idea.
It is.
Is it the Philippines?
Our Kiwi friends.
Ah.
New Zealand.
Yeah.
Came out of the darkness
out of
and
nowhere.
just blew up the stats and jumped into third place. Maybe it was the episode on Zealandia that did it. So very cool. Welcomed all of our New Zealand listeners. Canada, what are you doing, you guys? Tell your friends they got to start listening to the show and restore your place. I have a feeling, you know, maybe year four here. This is Canada's time to really shine. And I'm challenging you guys. Tell your friends, share this with a friend, and make those numbers soar, and do it for all that is, you know.
Do it for the maple syrup.
Canadian. Yeah, I was literally cooking maple syrup today, and I was going to say like, do it for the maple syrup, and I'm right, like, yeah. No, that's too cliched.
I'll then, say it,
you know,
for you.
I was literally cooking maple syrup today.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be we're racing the clock. It's getting real warm here.
Yeah. Well,
speaking of a cliche, do a segue for us.
I am going to tell a story that our Australian listeners might be a little more familiar with than our listeners from other places. I am kind of usurping Rachel's territory here. And the story I have to tell you is a mystery, which I have to tell you is based on the all-time most entertaining scientific paper that I have ever read.
Oh, we got a hint that you were up to something.
Uh-huh.
I got a text from Victoria that's like, I just read the greatest scientific paper of all time.
Oh, I didn't say greatest.
Like,
I said most entertaining.
Okay, most entertaining.
Yeah.
I meant I conflate great and entertaining. Those are the same in my mind.
I agree.
Sure. Fair. For the purposes of this show.
But please.
Yes. Okay, so I'm going to take you back to 1959. And Dr. Wow. Jack Barnes, a general okay. practitioner, was trying to solve a medical mystery. So Dr. Barnes lived in Cairns, which is on the east coast of the Cape York Peninsula in Queensland, Australia. It's the tropical area of Australia, very near the Great Barrier Reef.
Yeah. Okay.
And
this is also where the Gimpy Gimpy that I talked about just the other week, same kind of region. Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed. Well, I might be giving you another reason to stay away from Queensland because a mysterious phenomenon had been stalking swimmers in the area since at least 1922 is the first recorded instance of this phenomenon, but I'm sure it had been happening for long before that. And it is called Irukandji syndrome. And
what?
This, yeah, Irukandji. The syndrome was clearly occurring after some kind of sting received in the ocean. However, the sting itself was not very painful. Sometimes, you know, people wouldn't even notice they had been stung, or they would only feel a light brush against their skin.
Okay. Sure,
sure. But then 10 to 50, 50 minutes later, the victim would start experiencing excruciating pain, often starting in the armpits or lower back.
Okay.
Then spreading to the abdomen and the chest. Most of the muscles in the body would cramp or spasm. And
this sounds like a bad time.
This victim would start sweating excessively and vomiting.
Oh.
Yeah.
This sounds bad, especially if you're still in the water.
Yeah. Yes. Well, yeah, it's bad. Yes. You're in pain and now I'm sweating.
Yep.
And then throwing
and
up.
And there's also, tachycardia, which is a racing heart, like high heart rate, significantly elevated blood pressure. And some people would have trouble breathing either because of the amount of muscle cramping they were experiencing, including the diaphragm, or possibly some fluid backing up into the lungs. You know, luckily, almost no one died of it.
You know,
if they were in the water when it started hitting them, yes, sometimes people could drown, but there's that delay, which usually helped with that. And if somebody had some kind of underlying condition like an aneurysm, the elevated blood pressure and so forth could mean bad news. But mostly people didn't die from it. It just was really, really unpleasant. Victims would make a full recovery in, say, 2 to 7 days, depending on how bad of a sting they had had. But this is really awful experience that anyone would care to avoid.
Okay. I'm just picturing like you get this sting and you're feeling awful and you're like, I'm just going to rest under this tree over here.
Oh, no.
And it happens to be a gimpy, gimpy tree/plant.
Yeah.
And now you're in the worst situation possible.
Sounds
if you don't know what on earth I'm talking about, go back a couple episodes and listen about the gimpy, gimpy. Oh, gosh.
For real.
Okay.
Okay, so a Dr. Hugo Flecker had described the syndrome in the 1940s, and he had suggested the name that it had in 1952. So the name Irukandji actually is the tribal name of the Aboriginal people of the area.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And Dr. Flecker had been obsessed with finding the cause of the syndrome, but he had died in 1957 with this mystery still unsolved. The other doctors in Cairns also wanted to get to the bottom of what was going on. And so they asked Dr. Jack Barnes to take over the investigation. And apparently most of Flecker's notes had mysteriously gone missing. So Barnes kind of had to some extent, start over just based on what he could find published. And, you know, based on what he knew and kind of what he investigated himself, basically, all of the usual suspects had been tried and acquitted. Specifically, they tested a particular jellyfish on willing volunteers to see if they got the syndrome. Yep.
That was my first thought, was jellyfish.
Yeah, so they tested box jellyfish. There's another kind of local sea jelly known as colorfully a snotty.
I love Australian. Love it.
Amazing.
Also was not a Portuguese man of war. Call back to a recent episode. Thank you, Rachel. Or any other known local stinging marine species. And
imagine signing up for these studies and being like, yeah, sure. Yeah. You can slap some stingray or some jellyfish on me.
Well, based on what we're going to hear in this article,
no.
I would hesitate to say that it was anything so formal as calling for
Oh, no.
Volunteers.
I don't like where this is going.
Okay. So other things they had tried.
It was the 50s.
Yeah.
Other things they had tried were exclusion nets, both coarse and fine, to no avail. People were still getting stung, even if there were nets around the swimming area. They had tried. So when people started getting stung on a particular beach, they tried stationing observers in the water to try to see what was stinging them.
What?
And the only thing that happened was the observers also got stung, but they couldn't see anything. Yeah,
they got stung.
That makes sense.
And they were also able to dismiss the idea that it was some kind of atypical or allergic reaction to a known species based on the data they were seeing. There was one particularly instructive case study where a six-year-old girl was stung while sitting on the beach, and she was just at the water's edge, and the waves were kind of lapping over her feet. And then a bigger wave came up and washed over her legs and her crotch, and she was stung on the inside of her left thigh. And the area became reddened slightly, and so did a matching sting area, like, on the outside of her left labia. So, like, it had gotten caught in between, basically in the top part of her crotch.
Ow.
Interesting, okay.
So it was, like, he calls it a kissing injury. So, like,
okay.
Yeah. So after combing through all the data, combing through all this data, Jack Barnes was left with the following conclusion. He was looking for something that was very small, but not microscopic, because people could feel it brushing against them.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to be transparent, accounting for the fact that it was not being seen.
Right.
Yeah. And he was also able to make a correlation with certain wind and current conditions on the two. He found like two beaches where like 85% of the stings were occurring. And he figured out that they were occurring under certain conditions of wind and current.
Okay. And something's getting like blown in or something, right?
Yeah. But based on other stuff, they also knew that this organism had to be motile. Like it could move under its own power. It wasn't just being drifted in. But like when certain types of like clear water from the ocean came in, that was when the stings were occurring. So now that he had pinpointed when these were most likely to happen, of course, he went to the beach. So he knew the organism was likely to be able to move on its own, as I said, and also to be found in the top 18 inches of water. Because that's where people were getting stung. So he and his fellow searchers concentrated, like would get into the water and then would concentrate on trying to see any small movement in the top 18 inches of water of something very small. And they eventually captured two extremely small sea jellies, each about a cubic centimeter in size, plus the tentacles.
Okay.
And then he took them back. Yeah, then he took them back to the lab to study them. Just kidding. No, he let them sting him, his 9-year-old son, and brave lifeguard in the inner forearm.
His 9-year-old son.
Yes.
It's like, come on, buddy.
Yes.
No.
God.
Oh,
that's horrible.
Yes.
That seems to go against some sort of ethical, I don't think the ethics committee would allow that.
I don't think the ethics committee really existed at this point.
Wow.
Nah, mate.
That's.
Okay.
Oh, God.
Okay, I don't like this guy, but and what happened? Did they get stung?
Well, yeah, all three of them soon manifested the classical signs of Irukandji syndrome, which Barnes then describes in vivid detail in his paper. you know, they were in agony on the beach for a while, and he started adding in some additional details that weren't kind of in the classic literature already, such as the muscle cramping was along with an inability to sit still. And he gave this charming detail that the muscle spasms caused the victims to, quote, adopt a stance which I can best liken to that of an infant with a full nappy, unquote.
All right.
Nappy being diaper.
This guy is such an asshole. That he was like, I was still stuck in the hole that he stung his 9-year-old so he could study what would happen.
Yeah. Why did he bring his 9-year-old?
Like, speak yourself, the volunteered lifeguard, sure, that's an adult who consented to that. But like, this sounds like really horrible. And to be like, oh, I know this is horrible, you know, this would be a good thing for my 9-year-old to go through.
Right, right. And then they have this horrible car ride to the hospital.
Right.
They make it to the hospital. They're given some opioids.
What happened? My dad used me as part of a medical experiment.
Experiment here? I'm trying to find the origin of this weird disease. Or not disease, but phenomenon.
Syndrome, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all kinds of messed up. So they get to the hospital. They're given some opioids. Then after the opioids, for like 24 hours, they start getting these kind of shooting nerve pains all over their body. Aspirin helps with that, though. They get some fluids, makes them more comfortable. And, you know, within about 48 hours.
They didn't give the 9-year-old more opioids?
Well, you know, he had plenty already.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
They recovered within like about 48 hours. So, yeah, this is an insane thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it is.
It certainly did effectively prove the causation of the syndrome.
That's true.
Yep. And for Barnes's efforts, the jellyfish was named after him. It's Carukia barnesi. Although, in fact, there are several other species which all now fall under the umbrella of Irukandji jellyfish, which are all quite similar and they all produce the syndrome.
Okay.
So, in fact, these species are the
small... call it like negligent father syndrome or something.
Yeah, seriously. These are actually the smallest sea jellies in the world.
Oh.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And they are in the box jellyfish class and are some of the most venomous jellyfish in the world, as well as being the smallest. So, super fun. Clearly. Yeah, they're also found... So, they're found off the coast of tropical Australia, also found off of Papua as well. Where, in fact, the local people have, of course, known about the identity of the Irukandji jellyfish for
of course,
forever, yeah. approximately. And, you know, most likely the Irukandji people knew also, if anyone had bothered to ask them. Barnes himself actually realized this after his experiment, but before writing his paper, because he found somewhere in the literature an account from 1944, so during the Second World War, from a lieutenant colonel in the Allied forces who was stationed in West Papua, and a soldier got stung in the water. And the lieutenant colonel's native house servant recognized the symptoms and went and got a local healer who was referred to in the paper as a witch doctor.
Okay.
Charming.
Yeah. Who then he said, I know exactly what's going on. And then he sent divers from his people to go and retrieve and show the lieutenant colonel a specimen of exactly the jellyfish that had caused this.
Nice.
And so not only was this known by the traditional healers and the people in the area, but it was even in the Western scientific literature, but it just, you know, it's harder to find stuff before the internet. So
yeah,
that is true. That is true.
Yeah. Yeah. As we've talked about many times on the show, there's often traditional knowledge that is ignored or overlooked. And in this case, apparently, the healer also knew a cure. The account said that he got some leaves from the forest, chewed them up, and applied them to the sting as a poultice, and it cured the soldier almost immediately.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Yeah, if there is, in fact, such a remedy, it remains unknown to science. And there's a little more sophisticated now than in 1961 or whenever all this happened, but treatment is basically of the symptoms still at this point. Opioids and other stuff to keep you comfortable and bring your blood pressure down.
Oh, wow. That is really something.
Huh.
So this paper, which is a hoot to read, is called Cause and Effect in Irukandji Syndrome by J.H. Barnes for the Medical Journal of Australia in June 1964. Because it took him a few years to do all the research before he figured it out. And then I also got some information from an article in Emergency Medicine News by Leon Gusso that was talking about this paper and Wikipedia.
Cool.
Very cool. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Victoria.
I found this and I had to share it with you all.
Awesome.
Thanks.
We are going to take a little break, and when we come back, it'll be Kirk.
Science.
What is it? Who does it?
Why does it matter?
The Science Night podcast answers these questions by giving scientists a place to tell their story.
We also highlight science news and discoveries that will have you asking, "My God, what have I done?"
What weird thing are we going to talk about this week that involves a frog?
They made an organic robot? Like, didn't they see The Matrix?
Join us every other Friday, wherever you get podcasts, and at scinight.com.
Welcome back, everybody. I talked a few months back about Louis Pasteur and how he identified bacteria as being what causes many diseases, although he really wanted to find out what was making beer go bad. But
right.
So that was a pretty revolutionary discovery, but it got people thinking, are there other even tinier things that are smaller than bacteria that are out there that maybe we can't see so well? And in 1892, Dmitry Ivanovsky wanted to figure out what was causing tobacco plants to become diseased. Obviously,
yes.
Huge cash crop.
Mm-hmm.
And he's thinking, like, there's something making these sick. We really got to crack this nut because people are losing a lot of money. And they couldn't figure out what was making them sick. They thought maybe it would be a bacteria because bacteria had been discovered now. And they looked and looked and looked and looked, and there was just no bacteria that was making it sick. So what he did is he kind of basically liquefied some of these plants that were sick and then passed that liquid through essentially a filter that would filter out anything bacteria size and above. So we just had this sort of pure liquid when they were done. Mm-hmm. And then wanted to see if we mm-hmm. apply that liquid to the tobacco plants, do they get sick? And sure enough,
they
end up getting this same disease. And it's like, okay, huh. So we're dealing with something very, very tiny, something so tiny that it couldn't be seen. And he came up with a name for this thing. He called it a virus.
Yes, he did.
Okay.
So this is where this idea of viruses came from. But it was just an idea, really, at that point, because there was no way in 1892 to actually see a virus or figure out what it really was. We knew it was some little tiny thing that must exist that causes disease. It wasn't until 1935 when we had the scanning electron microscope that researchers were actually able to image a virus for the first time. And you know what's really funny? Guess which virus they imaged?
The tobacco
mosaic virus.
Yeah, the tobacco mosaic virus, the very same one that had been discovered. So that is very cool. That kind of basically proves that, yep, here's the actual physical thing, this tiny thing. So that's very, very cool. However, one of the things I think is really cool that I learned not that long ago is that because of how viruses were discovered, which was filtering out like the big bacteria, we thought that viruses were these things that were smaller than bacteria. But what we eventually discovered is that there are actually viruses that are even larger than some bacteria.
Oh, yeah.
There are big old viruses out there. And the only reason we didn't know about them is that we didn't know to look for them.
Huh.
Right? And the technique we were using to look for viruses excluded all the big stuff because we knew viruses weren't big, right? So get rid of all those stuff. Turns out when we looked at some of the, when we filtered out to get to the bigger size stuff, we were like, oh, hey, guess what? There's viruses here too. So that I thought that was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
So, trying to research things that are small is incredibly difficult. And to some degree, obviously it helps to know what you were looking for. Once we knew what to look for in viruses, we started to find more and more of them. We can find viruses and bacteria now because we know to look for them. But if you don't even know something exists, it can be hard to know where to look or even how to look. And we talk on this show a lot about how nature laughs at our little boxes and how the lines become blurry when you look closer and most things exist on a spectrum that isn't easily divided up. Well, generally scientists would agree that bacteria are alive, meaning they are living things, but viruses mm-hmm. get kind of stickier. Like bacteria can generate energy, they can make their own food, they can move and reproduce. So generally we say that basically makes them one of the most basic kind of units of life.
Right.
Viruses, though, even though they're made up of DNA or RNA, they actually like do things like hijack the machinery of other living things to reproduce. They can't do it on their own. They also don't have cell walls. They can't make energy. So sometimes we say that they're basically like quasi-living, not quite living things. And I'll point out that there actually is disagreement among scientists, and some are actually arguing that no, viruses are in fact a form of life. They should be in their own, you know, category of life and whatnot. And it's actually a really fascinating debate that we're not going to solve here today. But I think it leads to a question, like, which is interesting, which is what if there were other small quasi-living things other than bacteria and viruses?
Like prions.
Like, what if we... Yeah, well, what if, like, that's a good example too, but like, what are all these other little things? We keep on finding other ones, so like, maybe other ones are still out there, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And I've spent my whole life knowing about viruses and bacteria, but what if that's not the whole story? It's an interesting question, and guess what?
Do you know something?
The real reason I've been talking about bacteria and viruses this week is because I want to be able to differentiate them from something new that has been discovered. A team at Stanford University announced very recently that they've discovered a microscopic biological entity. It's a very carefully chosen phrase there.
Uh-huh.
That is not bacteria and not a virus.
Wait.
And they've named these new entities obelisks.
This was on my list. I read this article. You started going.
I have not heard anything about this. Oh my gosh.
I was just sitting here. All right, so wait.
It sounds familiar. So this is like brand new. We don't even have all the information on this yet. The team is calling these obelisks viroid-like. Now, viroids are fragments of RNA. They don't even have a coat around them for protection. They're literally just scraps of RNA floating around out there in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But they can still cause diseases. And we've known about viroids for a while. They're like the next size down from viruses. And what this team is arguing is that obelisks sit somewhere between viruses and viroids. It's kind of in a middle ground. And they're saying that they should be considered a new distinct entity.
Huh.
They are single strands of RNA. They have no protein coat like a viroid, but unlike viroids, they are able to encode for at least one protein. They've actually described a new type of protein that is made by these obelisks, which we didn't know about before. So it's like, okay, they can do more than viroids, but maybe less than a lot of viruses. So like, we're super curious, like what do they do? Like, we got to study these more.
Mm-hmm.
This research team found obelisks in human mouths and in our in our guts.
That's what I heard.
So far, they claimed, they claimed to have identified 30,000 types of obelisks.
What?
Just in humans.
Oh,
just
no.
In humans. Which is where they happen to be looking.
That's
wild. This is wild.
Oh my gosh.
This is also new that we really don't know what we don't know. There is some suggestion that at least one of the obelisks reproduces inside bacteria.
What?
So that's pretty interesting.
Okay.
And it's specifically the bacteria that cause dental plaque, which might explain why so many are found in our mouths.
Hmm.
But we don't know, like, anything about these. Are they beneficial to the microbiome of our mouth? Are they detrimental to the microbiome of our mouth? Are they completely neutral? Like, are they weakening the bacteria that cause these plaques? Are they somehow helping them? Like, we don't know anything about any of the stuff yet because it's so new. But I just think it's really cool to be alive when, like, all these new discoveries are made, right? Like,
absolutely.
Time will tell. And maybe this will get like absolutely ripped apart. I do need to point out, as far as, you know, source wise, this all comes from a preprint paper that was put up on a preprint server online.
Okay.
So this has not been officially published yet. It has not been peer reviewed yet. Although ironically, like, articles about this have already started to been like appearing in
newspapers,
journals
and stuff,
like Nature,
yeah,
and things like that. So, like, not just newspapers, like scientific journals. People are already writing about this.
Yeah.
Even though like the actual paper isn't out yet, which is kind of fascinating. So, but they're trying to, you know, get it reviewed and I'll get it published and whatnot. And then of course everybody's gonna jump on it and try to, you know, figure all this out. And maybe they'll go, no, this is all your imagination, but it basically sounds like it's not going to be. So very cool. We don't know what any of this means yet, but it's sort of like me coming on here and being like, there's this new thing called viruses, I swear. And we know now that viruses play a big role in our lives. And maybe these obelisks also are something that we're going to have to understand to have a deeper understanding of medicine and health and all these things in the future. Or maybe it'll be like, no, they're just these quirky things that don't really do anything that affect us. So I guess stay tuned. Time will tell.
Yeah, so wow. Fun. I had not heard about that at all. That's super cool.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, that's what I wanted to share this week. Just a quick little like, hey, there's this new thing out there, which I think is...
There's a
so
new life
cool
form
that like this, it's always been there, but we just didn't know about it, right? Yeah. And basically the way they were finding this is by searching these huge data sets for like strands of RNA that were certain shapes that they suspected they would be. And it's even the techniques for how they found these is just, it's kind of on par with the bizarreness of like, we couldn't know about the viruses before we had this electron microscope. We kind of couldn't know about these until we had the ability to scan these data sets for little bits of RNA, which we, you know, couldn't do in the past. So it's very cool, all the new stuff we're learning, and it's very exciting.
Nice.
Well, look, we're going to take another break, and Rachel is going to round out the show this week, and we'll find out what she has for us. Hey, everybody, just a reminder, you know, you can contact us by writing to contact@strangebynaturepodcast.com. Or I know a lot of our listeners listen to us on the Podbean app, and we get a number of comments over there. We have been a little negligent about reporting on some of these ones, but I did see that about a month ago, and I'm going to try to get this username right. Dumplepings.
Love that.
I think is the username. Nice. Listen to the episode, A T-Rex with Lips. And said, this is another Australia listener, thank you, said, as someone who grew up in Sydney, Australia, there are birds, specifically magpies, who very much intend to take an eye out when they swoop.
Exactly.
So, yeah, we're talking about, you know, birds that would eat us if they could. And I've seen a few videos of magpies in Australia getting a little aggressive. So I understand. I understand. Birds. Thanks for writing in. Yeah, we always love to hear from people. So either, you know, contact us through any of our social media accounts or through Podbean or with our email address, contact@strangebynaturepodcast.com. Let's get back to the show.
All right, welcome back. This week on a new edition of Deep Sea, Why Are You Like This? We're going to explore yet another... wild deep sea creature that's fit for our nightmares. I'm gonna preface this that I've done something similar. The mechanism behind why this is strange is actually kind of like a topic that I've covered before, and you probably will catch it when we get there. But I'll make a note.
We'll be listening for
exactly.
It.
If anything, I'll tell you about it. So we're gonna dive pretty deep down. Well, we would dive down, but it's a deep sea eel that I'm talking about this week, and we can't get down there. So we're not gonna dive down. But this deep sea eel is found all over in temperate and tropical oceans, and is generally found anywhere from 1,600 feet to 9,800 feet deep in the ocean. Science, that's 500 to 3,000 meters deep in the ocean. It's a black eel, and it's actually relatively small when it comes to eels. And some, there's a little bit of debate. It is an eel. It is part of the true eels, but there was some debate on whether or not it was a fish or if it was an eel. It's an eel. It's a black eel that is averages around 2.5 to 3 feet long. They don't have scales, as is traditional for eels, but that's kind of where there are some pretty significant differences between this eel and some other counterparts of or other cousins of eels. So this is a really deep sea creature, and a lot of deep sea creatures have really large eyes in order to be able to like get all of the light that they possibly can. This one has really, really small eyes, to the point where they think that they truly just detect maybe some light, but not really forms or shapes. Okay, so tiny eyes.
Okay,
Their tail is really long and whip-like. They don't have any like pelagic fins or anything, or like pelvic fins, not pelagic. That's open ocean. Pelvic fins. They have a really long whip-like tail. That's what they use to move around and for some communication. The tip of the tail actually has a really special mechanism or a special thing that it can do. It bioluminesces.
Oh. Okay.
Generally, it will glow pink, and then sometimes it will have bursts of red that it will like use. But I bet you're wondering, okay, that's kind of cool, but why is Rachel talking about this? Who cares? Right? This isn't all
it's
that
already
strange.
Pretty cool, but
it's cool, but like it's not super strange. Well, this eel is able to open its jaw so much that the jaw size, that 2.5 feet, a quarter of that is the eel's mouth and jaw.
Oh no. No.
So a quarter of the length, quarter of the length of the whole body.
Quarter of the length
is the jaw.
Wow, okay.
Of the eel.
That's a lot. That's a lot to take in.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to picture. That's weird.
Isn't it?
That's real weird.
Yeah. So this is somewhat similar to a fish that I talked about number of episodes back called the stoplight loose jaw.
Yes, I was just thinking about the loose jaw. Yeah.
And it's a very similar looking mechanism actually to the stoplight loose jaw. The jaw hinge is located at the base of the head of this eel. And what happens is when the eel opens its mouth, its head, the whole thing is folded while it's swimming, and it will unfold and spread out horizontally. And it's a lot of loose skin around there, and it actually inflates like a balloon, and it inflates the jaw, the throat, and the stomach all get inflated like a balloon. And this,
it's like a parachute opening, kind of.
So glad you said that. So this is why it has the name gulper eel, pelican eel, umbrella eel.
Umbrella. There you go. Yeah.
So.
Oh, boy.
Yup. And you would think so way back when I talked about the stoplight loose jaw, when I talked about it. I mentioned that it consumes things that are so big that sometimes it will rot and actually cause like the fish to die because it was such a big meal that bacteria and everything from the meal rotting actually can kill it. Before it can digest.
Wow.
Exactly. That's not what really happens here. So it can technically eat things that are much larger than itself. But what scientists have found and what is theorized especially is that it actually uses this as a way to eat lots of things at once. So it will swim into a group of crustaceans or shrimp that are all like swimming together in a school. It will open up its jaw, eat as many as possible because it is a deep sea fish, a deep sea eel. And there's not always food availability. So you need to eat what you can get and as much as you can. So it yeah. will inflate, scoop up as much as it can, hold it in its mouth and start to digest as it expels the water that it gulped out through the gills.
There it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Wow.
They also don't think that they eat things like large fish, partially because when they've looked at the guts and everything of the gulper eel, they've never really found any like big fish or anything. Sometimes they'll find things like squids or octopi or anything like that, but or even okay. jellyfish. But the gulper eel actually have really small teeth that line those jaws. So it's not able to tear or chew any sort of larger fish because it doesn't okay. have the teeth for it. So it's eating things like shrimp or other crustaceans.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a wow. little nice, short, sweet type story this week. But I had to tell you all about the gulper eel. It's been on my list for a while. I don't know if y'all have seen, I will make sure that the pictures are on social media because they truly look, when they're fully expanded, it looks very balloon-like, especially with their little tiny eyes. It's just this huge sure. balloon and then like a really thin string, I guess, like swimming through the water. It's wild. We actually just recently got video of it, which is really cool. But that's what I have for very you all cool. this week. The gulper eel.
Oh my gosh. Thank you. We'll check it out, the photos and the video, and I'm sure you'll be putting it up on social media as well.
Oh, absolutely. So that's cool. all we have for this week. Thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Thanks everyone for listening to today's show. Be sure to subscribe. New episodes drop every Wednesday, and we love sharing this strange world with all of our listeners. If you would be so kind as to leave us a 5-star review, that would be great. It lets other lovers of the strange discover the show. You can reach out to us on social media by searching for Strange by Nature Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can send us an email as well. Our address is contact@strangebynaturepodcast.com. If you want more information about the show, you can also check out our website, which is strangebynaturepodcast.com. Until next week, get outside, stay curious, and embrace the strange.